Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Joel Gerke of National Review is in for Jim Garrity today. Jim will be back on Friday. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Normally good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today as usual, but given the subject material in our first martini, we're just going to say bad, crazy, and you decide on the first martini that we do today. As you may have heard, there will be an election for Speaker of the House next week, and the consensus choice of some, I guess that doesn't really make it a consensus if it's only the consensus of some, but Paul Ryan is the name that a lot of people have thrown out there to be the next Speaker of the House. It's a job he has said repeatedly he doesn't want. But he says the time is such that he is willing to take it if the conditions are right. And here are the conditions he set forth on Tuesday.
First, we need to move from an opposition party to being a proposition party. Because we think the nation is on the wrong path, we have a duty to show the right one. Our next speaker has to be a visionary one. Second, we need to update our House rules so that everyone can be a more effective representative. This is, after all, the people's house. But we need to do this as a team, and it needs to include fixes that ensure that we do not experience constant leadership challenges and crises. Third, we as a conference should unify now and not after a divisive speaker election. And the last point is personal. I cannot and I will not give up my family time. I may not be on the road as often as previous speakers, but I pledge to try and make up for it with more time communicating our vision, our message. What I told members is, if you can agree to these requests, and if I can truly be a unifying figure, then I will gladly serve. And if I'm not unifying, that will be fine as well. I'll be happy to stay where I am at the Ways and Means Committee.
So, Joel, you cover Capitol Hill on a daily basis, and there's obviously a lot of reaction to what Paul Ryan has said. I think most conservatives would say, yes, we need to be much better about our messaging. I think most people would be fine about Paul Ryan spending less time fundraising and more time with his kids. I think most people would like the idea of the individual member having a greater voice in what's going on. What's really got a lot of folks on the right a little bit nervous is basically him saying, I want no competition for this job and I want no challenges after I have the job. And, of course, folks are a little bit concerned about some of the issues that he stands on, most namely immigration is the one that's getting a lot of attention. So what do you make of the demands, and what do you make of what we're likely to see in the next few days?
The demands would be utterly unacceptable and weird if this were a normal speaker's race, but it's not. Sort of the first most salient point here is that we're dealing with a guy who doesn't actually want the job.
Right.
So he's not going to walk into a situation where he's got to haggle about what he's going to do in order to be given the job when he's never wanted it. And the whole dynamic that we've had before with the Freedom Caucus and with some of the people who have tried coup attempts was they will threaten to oust the speaker, or they will put pressure in different ways. And if Boehner doesn't do what they want, he'll lose the job. And that dynamic doesn't really work in this situation when you're dealing with a guy who is really quite happy to stay where he is for personal and political reasons. On the personal side, he's got a young family, and he probably could have been the nominee if he wanted to in 2012, and he didn't run, basically for that reason. And on the political side, he's got the chance to write the entitlement reform legislation he's been waiting to write for his whole career, maybe get it signed into law if the GOP elects a president, and be a conservative hero and a really consequential lawmaker who might have another presidential run in him years down the line. And he's supposed to give all of that up to take on a meat grinder of a job right now? This is not a thing that he's dying to do.
Where's the House Freedom Caucus right now?
I'm not entirely sure. My sense going on for a little while has been, walking into that meeting, a member of the House Freedom Caucus told me that the biggest fight for Ryan was not going to come from Freedom Caucus types, but from like Louis Gohmert, Steve King, some folks like that. Now, there is a little bit of overlap. The Freedom Caucus has Justin Amash, and it has Tim Poolscamp, who was pretty critical of Ryan after that, said he'd offered unmeetable conditions. One thing it sounds like they don't like, the details are a little fuzzy, but he wants to change the rules on this sort of constant threat of having the chair vacated. That is, this motion to depose the speaker on the House floor. That's a great annoyance to leadership, even though it's never really been done. But traditionally, the Democrats all vote for Nancy Pelosi, and the Republicans are all supposed to vote for the Republican guy. And then a simple majority decides who wins. But then if you've got 188 Dems to vote for Pelosi, then all you need are 29 or 30 Republicans to vote for anyone other than the current speaker, and he's lost the gavel. So that might be a sticking point. I'm yet to hear exactly what that'll do, how that'll turn out. You know, this whole speaker thing is kind of a Rorschach test for the party right now. My sense is that HFC is favorably inclined towards Ryan. This McCarthy thing stepping down was sort of a problem for them because they had set up this carefully constructed maximalist negotiating position, which really relied heavily on the idea that you've got somebody else who actually wants to be speaker. They promised to go hard at Boehner and then at McCarthy, and the whole theory was they would threaten to deny him the votes on the House floor, and then McCarthy just fails, and Paul Ryan immediately says, "Don't look at me," but everybody does look at him, and they actually like him more. So, but now they're committed, and it's a different dynamic.
Exit question, real quick here before we move on to the bad martini. If in fact Ryan doesn't get what he wants and doesn't get everyone to agree to this, rumor has it there's about 15 to 20 people ready to jump into a speaker's race once he would exit the stage. Is that accurate?
I don't know if it's 15 or 20, but there has to be another speaker. So we've started to see folks coming out of the woodwork willing to talk about it. Marsha Blackburn, Mike Pompeo. Marsha Blackburn could have a pro-life woman platform that could be appealing. Pompeo has Tea Party credibility on energy policy and is also an Intel guy in Benghazi. So there's that. One thing on this Ryan stuff that's interesting is, and that I'm hearing a lot about on the Hill, is the idea of, can this coalition hang together? Speaking very broadly, you've got moderates in one place, then other folks who are more conservative but might want to do incremental work. And then in some cases, you've got, I don't know if you call them radicals or revolutionaries or just maximalists who only want the maximum thing. The interesting test case of this Ryan candidacy and Ryan speakership is how many incrementalists are there and how many maximalists are there? Because right now, I think even a lot of people who would accept incremental reform are pushing for maximum reform because so many moderates are not really fighting at all. I tend to think that HFC is more incremental than they've shown. They're more willing to be incremental and tactical than they've shown, but that will require a leader who can actually drive a hard bargain with Democrats.
Moving on to the bad martini now and staying on Capitol Hill, for folks who may not be aware, there is a debt ceiling showdown on top of everything else that's about to hit here in the next few days. The president, of course, is rolling out his usual argument, and that is that there should be no strings attached to a debt ceiling hike. His argument, of course, is that these are things we've already agreed to pay. There's no need to get political gimmicks involved in the process. Others would disagree sharply with that. Tom McClintock, Republican from California, has for at least the second time introduced the Default Prevention Act, would essentially make sure that the debt is paid off, the interest on the debt and all the debt payments are made, regardless of whether or not the debt ceiling is extended. So the full faith and credit of the United States would not be at risk. The White House on Tuesday announcing that the president will veto that, which comes as no surprise. But Joel, when it comes to a critical issue like this and the nightmarish scenarios always painted if something's not done about the debt ceiling, this would seem like a pretty good idea.
There are a lot of debt limit ideas out there on the substance of the debt limit. How long should it be increased? What kind of reforms should be attached to that if we get that? McClintock's bill is really kind of clever. What he's really doing is he's depriving the president of the arguments that he used last time in terms of, we can't risk defaulting on our debt. I can't guarantee, he said in 2011, I can't guarantee that Social Security checks will go out. Republicans all said at the time, of course Social Security checks can go out. You can just decide to pay to prioritize those things because you've got tax revenue coming in every month. And Treasury replied at the time that they don't have the legal authority to do those priorities. They've got to pay the bills as they come up. And so McClintock is saying, fine, here's the legal authority to do that. And now the messaging is changing from the White House saying that this is just default by another name because you can't pay all of your bills. I think what you're seeing in that veto threat is a desire on the part of the White House to maintain the status quo in terms of the political landscape. When it's a game of chicken, they tend to win. They couldn't win in 2011. That's how we ended up with the sequester. But they figured out the messaging on their side, and they have won the last couple fights. We've had pretty easy debt limit increases that didn't have any strings attached. So it looks pretty transparently like they're just trying to preserve that brinksmanship opportunity.
Moving on to the crazy martini now, Joel, and we head over to the Middle East. Jim and I talked about this a little while ago about John Kerry suggesting that everybody needed to calm down in the Middle East. You had the imam in Gaza encouraging Palestinians in the West Bank to go around stabbing Jews, and there would be a curfew of knives, essentially. It got to the point where obviously Israeli defense forces were much more vigilant and were able to actually shoot and in some cases kill people who are trying to stab Jews over the last several days. The Kerry comment was, of course, that this is all related to if only the Israelis stopped building more settlements in the West Bank, this problem would all go away. Another thing, of course, that is happening, which is coming as no surprise, but the egregiousness probably does, is how the media is covering this. And your colleague, Ian Tuttle, who's a friend of ours here in the Three Martini Lunch, has written about this in great length. And just looking at some of the ways and the euphemisms that the press uses to explain what happened, six Palestinian teens die amid Mideast unrest. Well, yeah, it's because they were trying to stab an ultra-Orthodox Jew and two Israeli police officers. Israeli police officers killed two Palestinian men. Guess why? Palestinian youth now will fight. Israeli-Palestinian tensions escalate with four violent attacks. So the balance in the media is always in question, Joel, but when it comes to this issue, it's jaw-dropping sometimes.
I'm not a big media critic guy, but earlier this week, there was a story out of Florida about a 9-year-old kid who threatened his grandmother with a knife. And the headline was, 9-year-old Florida boy threatened grandma with knife. And then you've got, as you just mentioned, that LA Times headline, which is six Palestinian teens die amid Mideast unrest. And it's like, if the LA Times used that same editorial sensibility on some other high profile stuff, it'd be like police ruin O.J. Simpson's white Ford Bronco. You really got to work hard to figure out a way to have the perpetrator be the aggrieved person. That's what we're seeing, just sort of jaw-dropping, running through all these stories. And Kerry's position seems to be like he's afraid of offending the Palestinians more. And so you have the State Department talking about how there might be settlements, or certainly we've seen, you know, John Kirby said, certainly we've seen that both sides can be capable of doing things that are acts of terror. The facts on the ground are pretty clear that in this case, at least, it doesn't seem to be about settlements, because the people who are committing the stabbings are saying that they're not about settlements. They're about a baseless fear that the Israelis are changing the status quo with respect to the Temple Mount. It looks like another example of the administration refusing to accept the terrorists' own explanation about why they're doing what they're doing. The media, for some reason, being incapable of actually using active verbs to describe, you know, what Palestinians are doing.
Yeah, the moral equivalence, I think, is the thing that just galls most conservatives and anyone who has an objective view of what's going on there. The administration, not only are they trying to use moral equivalence, but it's just such a departure from U.S. policy in the past in response to things that are clear about what's happening and what the motivation is behind it.
It's so egregious that it almost works. You don't want to assume that these headline writers are being hacks or try. You assume they're acting in good faith. So what could they possibly be going off of to get to this place? But it's just like, how do you write a story about police killing two Palestinian kids that emphasizes that while de-emphasizing the fact that they killed the Palestinian kids after the Palestinian kids stabbed a bunch of little kids riding their bikes? There was a 7-year-old Israeli kid murdered. It's really remarkable.
It's amazing, and it's a mess, and it's, like you said before, hard to figure out how it's going to get reversed anytime soon. On that sobering and depressing note, thanks so much for filling in today. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Joel Gerke in for Jim Garrity today. Joel will be back tomorrow, as will I, for the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch.